Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and today's episode is going to be a four questions with Jonah Mazur. I first met Jonah when the Sherman Oaks Film Festival hooked up in 2017 with the Millikan Middle School Cinematic Arts Academy. At the time, Jonah was in eighth grade, but he's since gone on to high school, and he's grown as a director and a cinematographer. In fact, in 2018, we showed one of his films at Film Invasion LA in June, and another film at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival in November, making Jonah, I think, the first filmmaker to be in both festivals in 1 year. But the reason I brought Jonah in to answer the four questions, and do you remember the four questions there? Favorite films of all time, a film you think is underrated, a film you think is overrated, and a lesser-known film that people should seek out. But anyway, I had Jonah in here because Jonah approached the Sherman Oaks Film Festival and said, hey, I'd love to volunteer and help out, and we're always open to volunteers. So while working with him, I was like, hey, why don't you come in and do the four questions? So he did. And unlike most four question episodes of this podcast, today we actually do chat a little bit about his background because I didn't get to do a full episode with Jonah. So this episode's actually his four question answers, and you get to know him a little bit. All right, here's Jonah. You're here to do your four questions, and you are assistant coordinator for the next Sherman Oaks Film Festival.
Yeah, no, I'm so excited. No, and I think the whole thing with that too, just getting a younger perspective of being through the film, you know, the festival, you know, circuit and stuff, and seeing what, you know, whatever we can do.
Yeah, well, full disclaimer, you're in high school, and you're a filmmaker.
Yep.
And you've been going to festivals with your films for how many years?
Probably 3 years now.
3 years of going to festivals.
Yeah.
And so now you're going to work at Sherman Oaks Film Festival and see the other side.
Totally, yeah.
Which has got to help you out.
Oh, yeah, totally. No, I'm really excited. And I've been really interested in, like, seeing the other side of things and, you know, just getting other standpoints on just a lot of different things. And so I think, yeah, it'll be super beneficial, I think, for sure.
I think so. Yeah. No, I know a filmmaker on Facebook, and she just participated on a jury of a film festival. And she posted, I would like to apologize right now to every film festival programmer who I ever said, you know, cursed quietly when I got the rejection. I totally get it now. You did mean we, you know, she's like, every time I got a letter that said, we love your film, but we can't take it. I always thought you were lying, but now I know it's true.
Yeah.
But you're here today to do your DIF4Q, which is Discover Indie Film Four Questions.
Yeah.
So go ahead, hit me with your first one, your favorites.
Yeah, I also think to start off too, I don't ever really like to say, like, I hated this film. I think that I, you know, in my head, I do have a list of, like, these are some films that I love and I've benefited not only as a filmmaker from, but also as a person from too, learning, you know, the lessons behind, you know, what can a film really teach you, as well as, you know, wow, like that, the way that they shot that was so interesting. How could I achieve that in my next thing or whatever? I think my top three, I don't think are in a very specific order, but I would start with, Baby Driver, a film by Edgar Wright.
Is
that 2017? I think it was.
Yeah, it might have been 16. 16. It might have been 2 years ago, but yeah. It might have been, yeah, I don't know.
But, no, Baby Driver is an amazing film. And I mean, for those who don't know, it's kind of about, like, this, like, getaway driver who also is kind of, he has a hearing problem, and so when he listens to music, and I think that was super beneficial for the film because they were able to play with, you know, all the different types of genres and stuff of music, and he's got all these great little iPods and stuff for different moods and stuff that he has. And I also think it's funny to me too, you know, how we make playlists and stuff for, like, you know, my feels playlist and, like, you know, the 70s road trip playlist and stuff like that. You know, you make these different playlists for different feelings. And I think that when they were able to do that with Baby in the film, I think that was just, it was so interesting. And also I could totally feel for that because I do that as well.
And an ingenious way of incorporating music into film.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Because yeah, music has always been so important to film.
Yeah.
And I'm actually blanking on the term when the music is, instead of soundtrack, it's
the score or no?
Not the score, but like wasn't the music in Baby Driver, like he was playing it. It was inside the
right, film. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
There's a term for that, which I'm forgetting.
Well, no. And I was lucky enough that, Edgar Wright, there was a screening of Baby Driver and then there was a Q&A with Edgar Wright after. And I was lucky enough to ask him a question. I don't remember exactly what the question was. It was probably like, what would you give advice to like a, you know, 15 or 16 year old filmmaker at the time or whatever. But he was talking about how even when he wrote the script, he had like a very specific software that he used when he would send the script to actors and different people attached to the film. And before each scene, there'd be a little button that you could press and you could play the song while you were reading the script.
So he had like MP3s embedded
in the script? Into the script.
Really?
So that you could literally play the song and then read the script and be like, this is the tone, this is the vibe. And I think music is one of the best ways to do that. I think to really set a tone, to set a mood and also like a style too. Like, and the thing with Baby Driver is I could listen to that soundtrack, you know, driving to school, driving to, you know, a lacrosse game.
It doesn't make you drive too fast.
No, well, right. I mean, just like the stunts that, but there, you know, and there's that opening sequence where there's like the group of three that goes and robs the thing and he's sitting in his car and he just jams out to this one song. But then right when they come back with all the money or whatever, and you know, he just bolts it. And you can totally tell because that song, you know, slowly builds up, and at that build up, he totally nails it. And all the choreography and everything it was just so well done. It was such an amazing film. And you know, he goes and walks down the street and little lyrics of the songs and stuff pop up all over the street and on little posts and stuff. And the first time you watch it, you have no idea that was even a thing. And then you go back the second time, you're like, what? How in the world did they do that? You know, he's like just going to get coffee. But I do think that, like, you know, I don't remember if it was New York or not, but I totally felt like that was like being a New Yorker or something and walking down the street listening to your music. And you, I think when you are walking down the street and listening to music, you're in your whole other world. You see, you know, whatever's going on at that time and you are listening to a very specific piece of music, everything changes. And I think that was such an interesting way of showing that. So
did he say in the Q&A, did anyone ask if like those songs that he embedded in the script, did those make it to the film?
Yeah, they were the exact.
That's rare too, that you don't have to compromise.
No, he was like, he also said that he got the rights to the songs before the film was made too.
Oh, so even at the screenwriting stage,
I think right before production, they were going into shoot the film. He was like, I need to have the rights to all these songs because again, like you were talking about what was his name? Ansel Elgort. Like he was going and doing movements to each piece of music. So if they would have switched a piece of music or something like that, he would have like there would have been sequences. Yeah.
Effect.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. So I mean, that was definitely just, you know, something as far as the filmmaking side of it. And then when you think about it as, what did I learn from that about as a person? I think what was super interesting about it was there's that song Easy, and he's like, you know, the whole thing was like it's easy like a Sunday morning. And I think that was super powerful to me because I think as a lover, I guess, in the film, you know, he's okay to take risks and do things for his girl. And I think that was like, that was something that I realized too, you know, with that, like Easy, he was like, it was very laid back, but he was also willing to, you know, to do whatever it took to make sure his girl was safe. And I think that was a very important life thing because it's like, you know, you, when you love someone so much, you would do anything for them. And so I think that was a big part of why I love the film too, is because he would do anything to make sure that she was happy and she was safe and she was okay. And I think that was something I learned that was like very, very, inspirational, I think, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And it said something to you.
Oh yeah, yeah, totally.
Resonated.
Yeah.
All right, well, that's your top for now.
Right, yeah.
What are some other favorites?
You get
to do three.
Three, yeah.
It's hard to... Three is a tough limit, yeah. But, you know.
My second one was Grand Budapest Hotel, and I think... it was so hard because Wes Anderson is one of my favorite directors because he is... It's just so different. He is so... He was inspirational again from a filmmaking point of view. The fact that if you turn on any one of his films, you know this is a Wes Anderson film. When I watch not a normal film, but like when I'm watching a film, I'm like, okay, who directed this? I want to know more about this director because he did this and this and this so well. But when you turn on a Wes Anderson film, you know that's Wes Anderson, and it's so well done. The everything from that very like 2D, like very flat image, yeah. But so vibrant and colorful. And,
yeah.
And then you have this character that's like the, not the security guy, but he's like
the maitre d', yeah.
Right,
or
right.
Not maitre d', he's concierge.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah. The concierge. And, but then he just wants to do anything to make his clients and the people that are staying at the hotel feel as good as possible. And he starts like, having these like love affairs with some of like the older, you know, the older ladies at the thing. And it's just, ugh.
And I don't think Ralph Fiennes had ever been funny before.
Mm-hmm.
And that might've been one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. He was so funny. As
oh,
that,
it was hilarious.
Completely playing it straight. A completely sincere, serious man.
Yeah.
Everything he said was funny.
It was, but he didn't play it as if it was funny. He played it so serious and so like straight on that's why it was funny. He is. And you know, I love just watching like little behind the scenes or interviews with the director, and Wes is just so smart. He knows how to do all that stuff. And it's like a whole new way of, you know, a whole new wave of comedy too.
Yeah. I'm a huge fan of his. And I actually do feel that every film, he keeps getting better.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I love the early stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And Royal Tenenbaums, a lot of it. But each film keeps getting better than the ones before.
Yeah.
And Isle of Dogs.
Oh, my God. Isle of Dogs.
Completely kicked my ass.
Yeah. So good.
I mean, and I thought Fantastic Mr. Fox was great. But then Isle of Dogs, I'm like, you know, maybe Isle of Dogs is better.
Yeah.
I just couldn't believe how good that film was.
No, that was... I mean, my family is also a huge, like, just dog family, and to see that film and like, and just having, you know, I think a dream of mine was always like, well, I wish my dog would talk to me. Like, I wish, you know, they talk about like how your dog's your best friend, but if my dog could really talk to me, I would not have any other best friends. It would be my dog. And so I think like to be able to watch that happen and see like these dogs interacting and also just how gritty they were too. I think that was so fun.
Their world. You're probably like me. The thing that got me most, but the thing that I wept. I just wept was when the female dog and Bryan Cranston's dog were talking, and he's like, "Why should I help him?" And she goes, "Because he's a 12-year-old boy. Dogs love those."
Yeah.
Hearing that dogs love 12-year-old boys, I was like, "Oh, my dog loved it." I was broken at that point.
Oh yeah, no, it was just so well done.
Yeah,
and again, but you know, sure, it's like a, you know, from a film point of view, you're like, make something that is so signature to you. To why, like, how is this a Jonah Mazur film? You know. Where can I be as a cinematographer, as a DP, as a director, whatever, that's like a signature thing. And I think that, you know, it's totally, it takes some time to figure out. But once you figure that out, I think you're, you know, to be able to turn on a film and be like, oh yeah, that was a Wes Anderson film. That was a, you know, da da da. It's like, that's powerful.
And Wes is one of those guys. I mean, you saw Bottle Rocket, obviously,
mm-hmm.
But Bottle Rocket was a short that did the festival circuit, and someone who saw it, I believe James Brooks, who was a producer of The Simpsons and lots of TV.
Yeah.
His someone who worked in his office saw it and brought Bottle Rocket to him as when it was a short, and I think he got it made into a feature. And I actually think it's flawed. I think Bottle Rocket is actually the short that opens it is like brilliant. The breaking your brother out of the mental hospital, but he's actually free to go. But the brother is getting out of the mental hospital. Is like, yeah, my brother, I got to go along with this to make him happy. Like, I thought that was just brilliant.
Yeah.
And I think the rest of the movie, I just think he keeps getting better from that.
Oh yeah. No, 100%. And then I think my third, I would probably, it was hard because I didn't want, you know, of course, I could say Pulp Fiction. That, I mean, you know, you have those just amazing classics and stuff. But I put on there Rear Window. I think Rear Window, I saw that when we were studying film as a freshman. And I saw that film and I was like, it was just so interesting to me because, you know, when you're out with friends or you're out on a date or whatever and you... and you start doing like that people watching thing and you make up these little stories for every, like everyone that walks by, you're like, oh, that person, you know, could live down the street from me and he has this job and, you know, he's got a family of four, you know? And so I think that, that in that film, when you have your main character, that's just looking out the window and just kind of like piecing together little stories of each person, you know, where he's got that broken leg and so he has to just figure out something to, you know, to have fun with. And so when he is able to kind of piece together little stories as he's looking through these windows, you know, I think was so fun. And also, you know, I loved the fact that you don't really move from that set, you know, it's like that building, you have his room, and then you have all the, you know, him looking at all these other rooms, and it's like, and you don't move from that, and it was a whole film that was just in that one little...
Even though it's a classic Hollywood studio picture,
right.
See how there was a little bit of an independent spirit to Hitchcock putting this in a bottle, and yeah, you could remake that for almost nothing. They keep trying, I think, but they...
Yeah, no, it was, right, there's something about that, like, you know, kind of, even when you don't know exactly what these people are about, and, you know, and he assumed, right, the murder of the dog and everything, and it's like, you know, he's watching it all kind of unravel and stuff, and, you know, when he makes up these little stories about people and stuff, he's like, oh, he definitely did it, she was definitely the one, or whatever, and I just think it was so interesting, and Hitchcock, like, I think his style is another one of like those Wes Anderson things, you know, it's Hitchcock, but he was able to also just be free and open with some stuff too. I feel like there were, you know, times where he would just be fresh with things and, he watches things in his movies and, he would do, there would be different techniques and he would change things around. And that was also very inspiring to me because it's like, it doesn't have to be so like, so 1, 2, 3 and you could play with it too. So
yeah. Did you take like a whole class on him?
It wasn't all Hitchcock. It was kind of like early film history sort of, and up to kind of, I think we ended with like Hugo, which is another one of my favorite films.
That's a great film.
It's so good. That was definitely up there for one of my favorites, but to be able to also watch like from Chaplin and, you know, you see like the very, very beginning of film and then you just watch how it progressed, but you still know that film is film, you know, and it's so,
it always
awesome.
Fascinates me. Yeah. I love that you've seen that stuff because I took a class in college that was just Hitchcock for 10 weeks.
Wow.
And it's just, yeah, it's wonderful to see just how the breadth he has. Because everyone thinks of him as Psycho now, I think. And you know, he covered a lot of ground.
Yeah.
And I love seeing classics because I think some classics completely not dated. Sometimes you see something, you're like, okay, that's of its time.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see something else and you're like, you know, I think Casablanca, I don't know if you've gotten to see it yet, but Casablanca, when you see it, you're like, wow, that could be... That is completely current, even though it takes place during World War II and it's a black and white film,
right?
Starring
yeah.
Humphrey Bogart, it's like an icon.
Yeah, and how powerful are the films that stay relevant forever? You know what I mean? And I think you know, I think that's another thing to, when you, you know, when you go and write a film, it's like, how can I also make sure that this movie isn't just going to be outdated in the next year or whatever? Even when you are focusing on topics that are super controversial to today, you know, I think, making sure that your stuff is able to live on and can be relevant later on, I think is really important too.
Well, those are a good three. Yeah. I like it. I like you tossed in, well, besides the fact that I agree with them.
But, right.
but your next question is the underrated film that you think people don't give the props it deserves.
Okay. There were two, but now that I think about it, there's this film, again, I think it was pretty recent, but there was this film called Okja, on Netflix. Do you see that?
I don't know.
Oh, wow. Okay. So Okja was like this great piece on this young...
How do you spell it? Just let me know.
O-K-J-A. And it was like this young, I mean, she seemed like she was like 12. And she was like this caretaker of like this, like, it was almost like an elephant, but then at the same time, it was kind of like a... It was like this big creature, but like at the beginning of the film, you see how like lovable and friendly this like creature is. And soon into the film, this company kind of comes to take this creature away to, start like this whole new meat, industry. And it's, you know, first of all, you grow to see how, you know, how loved this creature is, to especially to this young girl, and then they just want to sell it for meat, and it does go a lot to,
wow, what's quite the message,
right? Exactly. I think you know, it you know, she, the young little girl, you know, suits up and she's like, I'm gonna go get my, you know, my friend back. And I think that's it was so powerful. And just you at the end of the film, you see like hundreds and thousands of these of Okja, like multiple of them, and you know, in line to get killed for meat. And it's like, I mean, when it in a way, you know, you kind of goes back to the, you know, a little bit of like the Holocaust references and stuff, you know, you kind of go back to that and you're like, you know,
right? So they didn't hold back.
They
went beyond, you know, whether or not vegetarianism is more ethical. They went all the way to human life.
Yeah, they went full force. And the worst was when they show one time where one of them actually does, they pull the trigger and you hear it and you see it, you know, you just see the big thing fall to the ground, and it's like, oh, it was so moving and powerful. And, I saw it on the way to, Italy for a film festival, and I was crying the entire flight. I was like, I'm never eating meat again. This is, you know, and, but it's like, and I think it got a lot of praise, but I don't think it was as big of a film as...
Was it ever theatrical, or was it a Netflix original, or?
I think it was a Netflix original, and so...
Or something they picked up.
I feel like it was an original, but I'm not, it might've been something they picked up. And the only, I think, it was just one of those that was just didn't get as much praise as I wish it would have.
Well, that could have been your number four. That could have been your lesser known that people should seek out. I haven't heard of it.
Yeah, I think that one, and there's a smaller film called Super Dark Times that was it was another one that was on Netflix. I don't know if they picked it up or not, but about just a group of friends that kind of get into kind of a misfortune of events and stuff, and kind of
Super Dark Times.
Super Dark Times, yeah. And that was just another one that I wanted to throw out. That was kind of like, it was just done very well. The cinematography, the film aspects of it was done so well. But it was like one of those that really did not get a lot of praise either. But I definitely would recommend both of those films for sure.
Excellent. Definitely. Well, and hopefully you're providing, like we talked about, like a young perspective, like Super, Super Dark Times should be probably something that people my age should check out.
Right? Yeah. And I mean, the title really goes, it's super dark. It's super duper dark, but it is awesome.
But these are dark times.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. And I think it goes back to the point where when these films have like that underlying little bit of like, you know, what the world is today sort of, I think it's so powerful, and you kind of just get a glimpse of it. It's awesome.
Yeah. You know, and on the filmmaking front, sometimes I do believe in the title theory that like a kick-ass title makes for a kick-ass movie. Yeah. You can have a great movie without a great title, but like you get a lot from a title. I think you do. I think it's all part of the inspiration. And that's a great title.
Yeah.
In fact, Okja, I probably would have heard of it if they had a better title.
Right. Yeah, well, it was, I think there could have definitely been a different name for it, but I think that it was very personal to the animal and giving the animal that kind of praise and stuff.
Well, your next question is not about insulting a film. It's the overrated question, but overrated, you could love the overrated film. You just think
it was just got
the awards it got, right, or the praise it got, or everyone telling you that's the best one ever, you know, and you're like, well, it's a good film. It's a great film, but it's not the best thing ever.
Right. Okay. So I think, I think this film was so well done. It like the visuals of this film, amazing. And you know, you go back and you watch this film, you're like, wow, I was like almost in this war, right? Dunkirk, I think, was one of those films that was like, I went to see it and everyone was like, oh, you gotta see Dunkirk. You gotta see it. And I was like, it was like, I walked out of the theater. I was like, okay, what did I take out of from this film? Like, what did I learn from this film? I just thought that it didn't, like, who are we supposed to love in that film? You know, it's like that you show these guys getting, you know, rescued from the beach of the, right, when Germany kind of took over France and they were kind of pushing everyone to the water and stuff, and you see, you know, the rescues and stuff. Again, one of the most amazing films that shot that I've seen. The cinematography, amazing. And but you just like, again, I think it was like, who am I supposed to be rooting for? Who am I supposed to be like loving at this? You know,
a lot of people didn't care about any of the characters. A very common criticism I have of that one. I've heard of that one. And by the way, you're not the first person to say it was the overrated.
Yeah.
Especially considering it was nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah.
A lot of Oscars. Was that they didn't, there was no part of the story that made you really care about the people.
Yeah. Yeah. And another quick one was there was a film called Downsizing, with
Matt Damon.
And it was a really good film until the very end, but it was like, I loved the idea, the premise, but I did think that it was like one of those that started so well. It was like, it was going in the perfect direction, but then he like goes on this adventure. It was like, where are you taking this movie? And so I think it was just a little bit, everyone was kind of praising that film as like, you know, well, what if we all got, you know, shrunk and we just, you know, didn't even take, you know, people were like, what, 5 inches tall, and it was like such an amazing idea, but I do think in a way it was a little bit, it got a little too much.
No, I didn't see it. I love that that's Alexander Payne, who's made brilliant films.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And like that one went off the rails for him, apparently. Because I've heard a lot of people say how flawed it is.
Yeah.
And a bad ending. But
yeah, exactly. You go through this whole journey. You're so invested into this film, and then it's like, really, like you had.
Yeah, no, a good film with a bad ending, and a so-so film with a great ending. Like the way you feel at the end of a film is kind of how you feel about the film.
Oh yeah, no, 100%. Right, right. A film can take you totally this way, and then you go down the wrong, you know, the wrong path, and you're like, okay, like, you know, I think, it also is kind of interesting to me, the films that do get a lot of praise, whereas they're, you know, because of maybe like an actor's name, a performance, or, you know, rather than the entire film, you know, so I think that's a big part of it. And it sucks when a film gets a lot of hype and you go to see it and it's like, and it just doesn't meet your expectations. I feel like that kind of starts to ruin it for you because, your expectations are so high. You're like, I'm so ready to see this film. You know, you grab your popcorn or whatever, and you're munching down, and you're like, what, why, like, what is this? What is the reason people were loving it so much? So yeah.
the expectations game is huge.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Because yeah, when you see a film and you've never even heard of it before, it's such a great way to see a film.
Mm-hmm. No, totally. Yeah. And that, I mean, I think what was on there too was like, least favorite film, I think, was
no, there's no least favorite.
Oh, okay, good.
No least favorite. The last one is the lesser known film, right, that you think people should look up.
There was a film in 2009. It was called Mr. Nobody. Did you see this?
Did you
see
Mr.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so it was starring Jared Leto, and the reason why I love this film so much is because you pretty much see him, you see Jared Leto as, it's like the last human on Earth that wasn't like, there was like some system where you were like, you got some injection or something, and so that you would like live forever in this place, this very futuristic society. And Jared Leto plays like the last human. He's very old. He's, you know, he's like 130 something. And he's like, he doesn't quite remember all the things that have gone on in his life. And he goes back and he starts just reliving, moments in his life. But then in the film, you see two types of worlds that he lived. One, his parents got divorced. And so one life was him going and living with his dad, and his dad slowly starts, you know, dying, and so he has to just take care of his dad, and his whole life is about taking care of his dad and stuff. And when he goes and lives with his mom, you know, he meets these girls, he falls in love with like his soon to be stepsister, and there's like this whole the whole film, again, with the music that they chose, it was very like kind of French, like that French indie type of music and stuff, and it was amazing. It is on the longer side of the spectrum, I think, but it was like, it's so worth it. You get to see, you know, the reason why I love it so much is it reminds me of those childhood books where you would read a chapter of the book and then you'd be like, okay, do you want him to go in that left cave or the right door, you know, or something like that, and you get to choose their reality, sort of. And so when you get to see two different types of lives that he could have lived, I think was just so, it was so interesting to be able to see like two different ways he could have lived. Right.
Right. Yeah. It sounds really dense because besides the two, his life was separated into two, but then in his lifetime, he ends up being this unique person who's the last one aging on Earth.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, right.
So sort of sci-fi with a very human story.
Oh yeah,
too.
Totally. And it's what also is interesting is in the life that he lives with his mom, or maybe the life that he lives with his dad, he ends up meeting some of the same people, and they play with that, you know, he's like, didn't I meet you somewhere? And he's like, you know, and so, it just plays with your head. It's very sci-fi. I personally think that's my favorite genre, sci-fi. It's that future that might not be as far as we think it is, you know? And so that's why I love making, films like that. But Mr. Nobody, 100% would recommend to go check that out.
I gotta watch it.
Definitely. Yeah.
All right. Well, just for fun, you want to tell me your least favorite?
Well, no. So what I was going to say about my least favorite was, I don't think I've ever really considered a film my least favorite film of all time. I think that there are some films that are out there that are, that almost put the audience as like, set the audience as like these dumb people, you know? It's like, what I personally, I don't like the films that make the audience feel dumb, or, you know,
yeah,
or feel,
or have no respect,
have
for
no
the
respect
audience.
For the audience. Exactly. And so those are the types of films that I don't love watching. And, yeah, because I think so much goes into making movies that why would you make a film that would, you know, be disrespectful to an audience or whatever. And so it's just like, why spend that time and that effort into making something dumb like that when you could be making something, you know, like we were talking about before, something controversial to today and something that's meaningful, you know?
Yeah, I'd like to think that's going away. It used to be a very big... It used to be very common that films would talk down to the audience.
Oh, yeah.
And there was an arrogance, I think, of the people running studios. Like, oh, the people, you know, the average moviegoer is so dumb. Let's just, you know, have a really stupid plot and they'll just go see it because we're giving them a star they want.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's happening less.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Because I think the public just doesn't respond to those anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think I'm very, very much into, you know, making films that are, that everyone's able to relate to in some type of way. And I would never, you know, the last thing I think I would ever want to do or a filmmaker would want to do is disrespect the audience. But when you see those types of film, it's like, ugh, you know, why am I watching this and stuff? So, but ultimately, I mean, I can't tell you how much I think film has changed my life. You know, you read books and they give you stories and themes and stuff to learn off of. But when you see live action stuff where you can really relate to characters and you can really, you know, see yourself in that role or position and you see the decisions that character makes, you're like, why didn't I make that decision? Or next time that happens, I think I will totally make that decision. And especially being so in love with the technical side of film, I love cinematography, I love editing, I love the cameras and the directing side of everything. And you learn, like, you know, in Goodfellas, that where he's walking through the kitchen and you just like these long takes, and you know, it's like it just those inventive moves and stuff that you're able to see in cinematography and just the technique of film that's so, it's advancing. And I mean, it's what keeps me going. I think it's so inspiring to me to be able to see things that you would just be like, how do they do that? And then trying to achieve it yourself is just, it's the best feeling, I think, for sure.
And that was Jonah Mazur. And on a personal note, I have to say that his contribution to the Sherman Oaks Film Festival and my opportunity to spend a little more time with him, and he actually brought in a friend, Evan Howard, who is not related to me. He brought in Evan Howard, who is a stand-up comedian, and the two of them did several things for the Sherman Oaks Film Festival. And for me, a 50-year-old man getting to know the next generation of filmmakers and performers, it's pretty cool. These are solid young men. They've got a lot of creativity, and I'm looking forward to seeing what they do. And now let's wrap this up. You can go to discoverindiefilm.com, and there you can watch nearly every film of every filmmaker who's been on this podcast, whether it's embedded in the website or it's a link out to elsewhere. There you can also link over to the Film Invasion Los Angeles website, which is a film festival I program that's every June, or the Sherman Oaks Film Festival website, which is the film festival I program in November. If you forgot already, that's discoverindiefilm.com. Thanks for listening.